and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. Before we get into the show today, I want to say something about yesterday and yesterday's show. We have an update from what we were talking about yesterday, which was the city of Auburn Hills considering the idea that they might opt out of the smart bus service and what that would mean for our larger transit picture here in Southeast Michigan. Last night, indeed, the Auburn Hills City Council voted 5-2 in favor of opting out of the suburban bus system. It also approved ballot language to ask voters if they want to pay 0.5 mils to create a city-run transportation system exclusively for seniors and adults with disabilities. I think anybody who lives in this region who's paid attention to our struggles with transit over the last 40 years has to mark this as a setback. The idea that a city as big as Auburn Hills and with as many big employers as Auburn Hills will not have public transit is going to be a real challenge to people trying to get around. And that is something that we just have not figured out very well here in Southeast Michigan. So the story, of course, is not over. The saga continues. We still have the Regional Transit Authority, which, if it were funded, would fill a lot of the holes in public transit and make things much better for people who rely on that to get around. So we have to move on and start thinking bigger about the solutions to this massive regional problem. Okay, so if you think about liberal legislation and liberal aspirations for legislation, I think you would not be mistaken to associate that with big things, big pieces of legislation that liberals themselves would say improve our well-being. They want legislation to bring immediate assistance to individuals and families, reducing a range of inequalities that persist in American life. It ranges from family and parental leave policies to universal pre-K and universal health care plans, expansion of the child tax credit, decarcerating our country, creating more housing and housing first policies, and maybe most notably in the last few years, passing the Green New Deal, a massive piece of legislation that would really reform the way we use natural resources and the way that we preserve the environment. So that last policy package would ostensibly put more money in everyone's pockets by investing in greener technology and public spaces to both create jobs and stabilize an increasingly chaotic environment. But these big packages that harken back to the days of big liberalism in the 1960s and in the 1930s and 40s, they just don't have much of a chance. Every time they come up for votes, we have some reason in Congress that they can't get passed. And every time that political process stalls, liberals point in the direction of Republicans, of course, who see government as performing a really different function in our society. And increasingly, they are pointing at moderate Democrats, people like Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, who often votes pretty conservatively. The collective idea here is that someone other than liberals themselves is responsible for the failure to get these things passed. But what about liberals themselves? What about these liberal policies and the history of liberal legislation? Have they also helped create distrust in government, making it harder, in fact, to pass big legislative packages now and in the future? This is exactly the argument that Yale professor Paul Sabin makes in his new book, Public Citizens. He says that with the 1960s public interest advocate Ralph Nader leading the charge, a class of nonprofit public interest professionals, most of them white men, by the way, made it easier for people to sue lawmakers. They opened the government up to more criticism and created a slow-moving political process which lowers the chances of passing broad legislative packages that Americans often, when you ask them about it, they say, hey, that seems like a good idea. But how true is this argument that Sabin is making? How much blame should liberals shoulder for creating a slower, more distrustful political process? And if it is true, how should liberals go about reinstilling trust in government officials and giving them room to innovate and pass expansive societal changing legislation? That is where we begin the conversation today. How do we get to a place where more people do trust in government, more people do trust in government programs and legislation to actually improve the lives of Americans? And with us to talk about that is the author of Public Citizens, Paul Sabin, who is a professor of history at Yale. Paul Sabin, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So this idea is really an intriguing one, and I think it's a call maybe to introspection, I suppose, would be the right way.
I think that's right.
Way to think about it. Rather than getting angry about Republicans, and no question, Republicans have done a lot in the last 50 years, especially to sow the idea that government can't be trusted, or to point the finger at Democrats who don't lean quite as far left or don't believe as strongly in the power of government. You're kind of calling on liberals or progressives to think about the effect of the things that we've done ourselves, that we've done to ourselves, perhaps, to help make it harder for people to believe in government. And you focus on Ralph Nader, which is a name that we haven't heard in American politics too much lately, but at one time was somebody who had a pretty powerful voice. Let's start there. Why is Ralph Nader and his story so important to what you're talking about?
Well, first, just thanks again for having me on. And I should be clear that I think a lot of anger is justified towards any of the things that are being undertaken by the right in American democracy right now. But I do support the ideas of introspection. I guess I come from as a studying history, you can learn from the complexity. And so why Nader? I mean, I think Nader is a great character and was trying to find someone in writing this book that could allow an exploration of sort of the evolution of liberal and public interest politics going back to the 1960s. And Nader both shows some of the heights of that politics, the passage of many of the crucial laws of the early 1970s, including the Occupational Safety and Health Act, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and other crucial pieces of legislation. But then he also, in some ways, you know, shows the lows, I think, of that in the 2000 election. When he kind of went outside as an independent and kind of taking on, criticizing Gore and kind of pursuing an alternative. And I don't want to go too far down into the 2000 election rehash, but I think it was emblematic of the ambivalence of people like Nader towards sort of the traditional Democratic politics and that has had lasting consequences. So he's a fascinating character. Again, the highs and lows of much of the story, I think, to be explored.
And much of what Ralph Nader is saying during this time period is, hey, the government isn't always looking out for you, the little guy, so to speak. We need ways to put checks on government that will make sure that the things that they're doing actually benefit the small person. And of course, I think here in Detroit, we don't have to think very hard to come up with the biggest example of that, which is his influence over safety in the auto industry. He really did encourage the idea that the government was not protecting passengers with the regulations. It was protecting corporate interest, and we changed all of that. I mean, the environment of auto regulation is fundamentally different today, largely because of what Ralph Nader did. Now, Ralph Nader would say, and I don't want to speak for him, but I don't think he would object to this. I mean, he would say, look, that was an important change. That was an important shift, and people were being killed before all of this by recklessness in the industry and government indifference. You say, though, that in addition to that, it makes it easier to question.
Well, no,
them.
I mean, I think that you get to really the point, the heart of the point that I'm making in the book, which is both recognizing the real problems that people like Nader were attacking and trying to rectify, and then trying to understand sort of the unintended consequences of some of those reforms. So I strongly agree with your point. That these were real problems, and so part of what the heart of my book goes from really 1965 when Nader comes out with his book on Safe at Any Speed to the election of Ronald Reagan. It's really trying to explain how did we go from the height of big New Deal, big liberalism of the Great Society to the Reagan era, and to show some of the ways that people like Nader played a part in that. And I think you're right to point to. One of Nader's innovations as a political figure was to argue that the government was sort of in partnership. Big government was in partnership with the companies against the citizens. And so auto safety was one example, but that was also true in environmental regulation and workplace safety and other places. And so that was a real issue. And so part of the argument that I'm making is that these liberals, were attacking an administrative state that had there were real problems with how it was operating, and these were real legitimate critiques. And you only have to look, at things nuclear testing in the atmosphere, or the spraying of DDT and the near extinction of the bald eagle, and the Vietnam War as a whole, and many of the fights over civil rights, to see that the government was playing complicated roles, and there was a real place for these outsiders criticizing the government and saying that it had to do more, and that it couldn't be trusted, because you take something like the Vietnam War, the government was lying to the people, and so that's the justification for the critique. The question is, like, when you create institutions to respond to that critique, what are some of the consequences of those institutions, and do they then accomplish the ends that are ultimately were desired?
Yeah. So when you talk about these institutions that were created, I think they fall into a couple of categories. One, of course, is bureaucracy, process, the slowing down of the making of law, and the increasing order of difficulty. That now attends especially broad and sweeping legislation. Talk about the things that changed that made it harder, just made it harder to get legislation passed.
I mean, I think that one of the important critiques was the sense that there were unrepresented groups in society. That labor, business, and government, those are the sort of the three pillars of the New Deal, post-New Deal state, that they weren't really being included. And that was what Nader talked about as the citizen. That's the title of the book, Public Citizens, is both related to an organization he founded, but really it was the idea that the citizen represented, interests that weren't being heard. So some of these processes include the involvement of loosely organized or differently organized citizens in the administrative process, and I think again it's a sort of a two-edged sword. On the one hand, there are things that were happening in the 60s, like highways being blasted through neighborhoods, that citizens then rose up in the freeway revolts to try to block those things, and that was a really important political action, both for for a variety of different environmental and civil rights. At the same time, now you can see struggles to build housing, to build energy transmission lines. Just this last week, some people may have followed a fight in Berkeley, California, over whether the university should be allowed to expand its enrollment And there was a lawsuit under the California Environmental Quality Act saying that, you know, that this need to be reviewed more carefully to understand the impact of more students on the quality of life in the city, and they were going to cut slash enrollment at the university in order to, you know, respond to this lawsuit. And so that, I think, is, you know, housing is one interesting example where the empowerment of the citizen is leading to the blocking of this public good, the construction of additional housing. And a similar story can be told around renewable energy infrastructure.
Yeah. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Yale history professor Paul Sabin about his book, Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. We want to hear from you as well during this conversation. Give us a call and tell us, how much do you trust government to pass big legislation that will change the nature of American life? What did you think of things like the New Deal or the Great Society, former big pieces of legislation that were intended to really improve American lives? Do you think we live in a different era where we can't trust government as much, or shouldn't, or should rely more on the private sector to improve lives, wages, and things like that? Give us a call and let us know if you think we should make it easier to pass big legislation like the Green New Deal, or think back to healthcare reform at the end of the 2000s. As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to social media, Facebook or Twitter. Put comments there and we'll work into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your connection to what's happening in Detroit.
WDET is your place for open dialogue about the issues that impact you.
Stay in the know.
This is WDET FM,
Detroit's NPR station.
This is Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. My guest is Paul Sabin. He's a professor of history at Yale and the author of a book called Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. In that book, he kind of poses a really important question about well-intentioned efforts by liberals or progressives or whatever label you want to put on them to change and improve American life, and whether those efforts themselves and some attendant activity are actually the reason, or part of the reason at least, that Americans are so skeptical today about the idea of big government legislation or programs. We want to hear from you as well on the phones. What do you think about the government? What do you think about big pieces of legislation like the Green New Deal? Is that the right way to solve our problems? Are the people who stand in the way of those things the problem? Or are the ideas themselves kind of self-defeating because they invoke images of failure and bureaucracy that just turn people off? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Facebook or Twitter and put comments there, and we'll work into the conversation. Before we get to listeners, Paul, I do want to talk about some of the other challenges you say that have developed to this kind of legislation. And one of them is the legal environment, this idea that if you don't like what the government is doing, if you don't like a piece of legislation, you can go to court to try to halt its implementation. And we see much more of that now than we used to in American society. You say this is one of the things that liberals like Ralph Nader also pushed for a long time, to be able to empower citizens, but it does have this opposite effect as well.
Well, I mean, I think it is, you know, it is a complicated story, and I think An example of that is the passage of the National Environmental Policy Act that was signed by Nixon at the beginning of in 1970, and that law led to environmental reviews of major federal actions. And I think that it's so, and litigation under that has blocks, stalls, slows, righted from kinds of projects. And you can see that both as continued necessity because the government often promotes or endorses, advances projects that might be bad ideas. In my view, something like some of the major pipelines or the coal projects, other types of things. If you're concerned about climate change, NEPA is a major tool to try to get the government to reconsider its plans for extracting energy resources. At the same time, as I was mentioning before the break, these kinds of environmental review laws also are being used to block affordable housing, new energy transmission lines that are, might bring hydroelectric power from Canada that is, green, green energy under the for climate purposes. And so there's really, I think what's important to recognize is this dilemma of, the need for review, environmental review. If you don't have environmental review, there are going to be a lot of terrible projects. But there has to be some way to maybe streamline or make more effective or more balanced this process so that necessary and worthy projects don't get stalled indefinitely. Because you were talking actually at the very beginning before I got on about transportation. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the reasons that people say it's so hard for Americans to build mass transit, railroads and subways and things like that, are all these delays that are associated with that kind of construction. We need these public goods. So I guess what I'm pointing out is this balance between the need for environmental review. If you go back at the history, it's clear that the government has done terrible environmental things. At the same time, we need the government to be able to act when it has to create these public goods.
Yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. I want to read a social media comment and go to a call and then get back to our guest. Michael on Twitter writes, Citizens United and related ramifications seem extremely important for context. Doesn't that result in the undermining faith for government to act in the interest of real people? Let's go to David in St. Clair Shores, who has a similar point. David, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, Stephen. Appreciate the conversation with the professor here. I guess kind of piggybacking, I suppose, off that tweet there.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, right? Like, I'm sure that you guys were going to get to this anyway. But private money in the public discourse, I think, is one of the biggest things continuing to proliferate government distrust. And I know that we've kind of hit on, the history here of, how the Republican Party, since, Reagan and Gingrich, have really done a magnificent job at creating this environment where people can't trust their government.
Mm.
I feel like that's such a big part of the root cause here. And Democrats, liberals, progressives, whatever label, as you've said, if and when the day comes when we do have, more control in Congress and in the White House, like, we have to have the Constitution to act to actually fix that problem.
Yeah.
And we have to step up if that day comes. And, obviously there's big money behind Democrats as well. So are we going to forsake that money to do the right thing? Appreciate you guys taking my call.
I really appreciate the call and that perspective, David. Paul Sabin, talk about money and the way it influences politics and policy, and whether that is also one of the things that makes people skeptical of the intent of legislation, I guess.
Well, I think that's right, and that goes back to certainly people like Ralph Nader or the group Common Cause, organized back in the early 70s. Really, were trying to attack the role of money in American politics and try to reform campaign finance laws, and that's been just a long struggle there, and really a crucial one to try to reduce corporate and elite dominance over the policy process. I guess the things that I would note there that I think are interesting just in the context of our broader conversation one is the reliance of the legal strategies of the public interest groups on a sympathetic court. And they were enormously successful in the 1970s with a variety of different kinds of litigation. But as the court has turned, that success has been more challenging. I think that one thing that the public interest movement hasn't been as successful with is turning to political strategies to accomplish some of these goals. They've been somewhat successful in various places of trying to pass nonpartisan like redistricting commissions at the state level, but that highlights another sort of irony and complexity, where you do sort of state by state solutions to something that's actually a national problem, and that then leads to a distortion of the political playing field that is causing kind of unintended consequences. I think it's really important to we can talk more about the role of money. And that is part of the effort by people like Nader to lift up citizen voices, is to try to counter money and special interest influence.
Yeah. Again, Dave, thank you very much for the call and the comments. Let's go to Mike in Chesterfield. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey there, Stephen. Hope everything's all good.
Good.
Happy 2222222 Tuesday. The thing I wanted to talk about, and actually I just added the professor's book to my Goodreads want to read section, so there's that.
It's
interesting. The thing I wanted to say, though, is I think the main issue going on with just government in general in the entire society is, what are the priorities of government? And I say that at each level of government, because I try and be involved in local, state, and federal issues, and it seems that there's no real mission statement for each level anymore, that people just expect, and I guess this is coming from a citizen's expectation that government, they oftentimes just think immediately to D.C., and then they just expect, oh, the government's going to do this, so I don't have to do anything. And so you have this real disconnect between actual citizenry and what the functions of government can be. And I cite this as something like, you look back to the end of World War II, and you see that the majority of people in government at that time were veterans of that war. And they were people who had to struggle through those sacrifices, had to go through all these issues, but they had a committed sort of vested interest within that government.
Yeah.
Today, though, it seems that being in government today, whether being an elected official or being a highly appointed bureaucratic official, that entails some type of celebrity, some type of high income, some type of personal benefit rather than servitude to the state, servitude to the society, being like the ultimate of citizenry. And so we don't prioritize our issues. We don't prioritize what the functions of each level of government can be. And we lose sight of what it means to be an actual servant of the public trust rather than what we see today.
Yeah, Mike, that's a really nuanced and complicated way of thinking about this, and I'm glad you called and said all those things. Paul Sabin, I wonder what your reaction is to what Mike's talking about here.
Well, I think that's a crucial point in trying to think about what is the meaning of public service and the role of government, and that's really the struggle that that my writing has centered around. I mean, I think there is a long history going back to the founding of the country of public elected officials using their service in government to private ends as opposed to the public good. So that's in some ways has been inherent to our process. The question is, two questions is, one, how do we improve that so that there's more public service going on and less private interest? And then I think that there also is, I guess, unfortunately, maybe a need for, I guess, how to put this, an understanding of the, and this is less about the issue of people serving their own personal interests, but a need for an understanding of the nature of compromise and sort of the flawed but necessary government. I think that we need that maybe that. Liberals need to kind of wrestle with that about how the government's not going to be perfect. It's going to make mistakes. We should criticize those mistakes, but we also have to sort of vocally support the government, even because it's going to inevitably, there's no way to have a perfect government. And I think that there have been times where the public interest community sort of outside of government has been able to maintain a sort of more pure perspective on the government. And that has then led them to pursue strategies that are less oriented towards kind of getting the government to be able to actually do things. And so I guess we live in a fallen, you know, compromised world, and we need to kind of think about how do we muddle through? How do we do our best?
Yeah. Again, Mike, really appreciate the call and the comments. Let's go to Mitchell in Farmington Hills. Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Stephen, for having me on your show. I think that, well, with what our nation went through in 4 years ago with Donald Trump, I mean, I do believe in our government. But because Donald Trump tarnished our nation in so many ways that people don't even realize of that he sort of used, yet he had all this government, and yet he kind of tarnished it by using money that he wasn't supposed to, or using money and just keeping it for himself and like doing it secretly, and yet it showed us that that he tarnished our nation, and yet he used his power of presidency due to the on January 6th with our state state capitol, and yet now that people still believe in him, and yet that the Democrats are trying to fix, and Joe Biden is trying to fix our nation and help save it to go back to what it once was before Donald Trump ruined it.
Yeah. The influence of Trump and his presidency on this question is really an interesting, I think, question to think about. And again, this is not about liberals doing things that compromise trust in government. It's about a guy who calls himself a conservative, at least. I mean, I'm not sure if conservatives would say they might accept that. Paul Sabin, I wonder what you make of the Trump effect on all of this and how it fits into this longer narrative that you lay out in the book.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question and very interesting one to explore. So the public interest movement that I write about was founded, you know, really between 1968 and 1972, which was, you know, obviously the first term of Nixon's presidency. Mm-hmm. And it was a very tumultuous time with the Vietnam War and sort of the latter part of the civil rights movement. And there was a lot of use of litigation to try to block things that, you know, these legal organizations were founded in some ways to sue the Nixon administration, and then they continued their role going forward as more permanent part of the American political landscape. And I think that if you go to look at the Trump presidency, it's very interesting. So if you know, we can be critical of some of the ways in which the public interest litigation is problematic, some things we've touched on, but you also can see the very active role that legal organizations played during the Trump presidency on immigration issues, environmental issues, government transparency. The ACLU, the budget, you know, exploded in terms of the donations and its activity, and that was true across the board for these external legal organizations. And so they were really invigorated to play this role of citizens challenging a government that was, in their, you know, in my view too, and in their view, you know, having some terrible ideas of things that should be done and acting in corrupt ways. So it really underscores, I guess, the balance that I'm trying to emphasize, where, you know, we still need these tools and these organizations. We just have to figure out, you know, how do we balance them with also the ability to get things done. So that's the dilemma and the challenge. But I think the Trump presidency, you know, really underscored the importance of citizen organizations in American, you know, political life.
Yeah. Okay, when we come back, we're going to continue this really wonderful conversation with Paul Sabin of Yale, whose new book is Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. I want to continue to hear from you on social media and on the phones. Have a number of Twitter comments still to get to. If you want to join us on the phones, 313-577-1019 is the number. 313-577-1019. We'll hear from Anthony in Southwest Detroit next. We'll also get to a number of the Twitter comments that we have, and we'll talk a little more with Paul Sabin about his book. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for joining us. My guest is Paul Sabin, professor of history at Yale and author of a book called Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. We want to hear from you during this conversation as well, what you think about the power of government to improve American lives through big legislation. Is that something you still believe in? Is that something you believe is possible? Or are you skeptical of the power of government to do that? Do you think that government is compromised in the ways that it might actually improve our lives in this country? You can join us on the phones. 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to social media and leave comments there. Let's go back to the phones here with Anthony in Southwest Detroit. Anthony, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning, Stephen. I'm just having trouble myself with the ideological framework of liberalism. To be honest, you know, I just don't really see in the Democrats that are in power today, I don't see much liberal, you know, ideology in them except, you know, LGBT and reproductive rights, for sure, that's liberal, but I'm not really seeing liberal ideals in them, and I don't think it accurately captures what we've been going through for the last 20, 30 years, which many have described as a reign of neoliberalism, which, you know, many have said is kind of more oriented towards private market solutions, and I do think we see a lot of people, you know, I don't know if you'd call them liberal, progressive, or moderate, you know, like let's take Gretchen Whitmer, for example, Debbie Stabenow, liberal, progressive, or moderate. And because I think progressive, I think it did mean something maybe 5-10 years ago when John Conyers was in there, but I'm not so sure progressive means a whole lot different anymore than liberal today. But, you know, you see, quote, liberals pushing public-private partnerships. Mm-hmm. So I really just think that the ideological framework's not correct, especially when you look at the security state, surveillance state, the foreign policy, and that liberals.
But you know, Anthony, let me ask you a question. I mean, if you think of some of the legislation that we're talking about here, Build Back Better or Green New Deal, those come from the Democratic politicians. Some of the Democratic politicians you're talking about, do you not consider those progressive legislative ideas?
Well, I understand the Green New Deal was created by the Green Party more than a decade ago. So,
but the Green Party doesn't have any members in Congress, and so the reason it's in front of Congress is because of the Democrats.
I just don't think that it would probably look the same as what the Green Party proposed 10 years ago, so I think the name usage is a little duplicitous on the Democrats' behalf. And when it comes to Build Back Better, that phrase has been in existence for over a decade, too. It was created by the World Economic Forum. And, you know, we have the neoliberal leaders of Canada, United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, all using it. So,
Anthony, I think that's a really important point to raise is how we think of these things and what category, I guess, that we assign to the people who are pushing them or proposing them. Paul Sabin, I guess the question to you is this part of the problem as well, that it has become harder to define what is liberal or progressive because you have so many other influences, especially inside the Democratic Party, that take people to different spaces. And I'm not just talking about someone like Joe Manchin, who is clearly a conservative Democrat, but as he points out, Anthony points out, you know, our own senior Democratic senator Debbie Stabenow, our Democratic governor Gretchen Whitmer, you know, they play in a collaborative space, I guess you'd say, with conservatives. Does that also make it harder, I guess, for people to trust, especially progressives themselves, to trust what's going on?
Well, there's a lot of complicated questions about this. I mean, I do think that coming out of the 1960s and 70s, you do see a fragmentation of Democratic politics and a lack of clarity about what sort of liberals stand for. And part of that is sort of what I was describing, where you had this previous liberal coalition that was sort of a big state coalition, big government coalition, that then as being criticized rightly on many cases for a new sort of issue-based issue-by-issue women's rights, LGBTQ rights, environmental issues, a whole variety of different efforts to try to pressure that state administered state. So you see sort of a fragmentation and complexity of that, and it does make it a little more difficult. I mean, I think one consequence of that, and this the general sorting out of politics in our country, is that increasingly we live in our own we live in bubbles and segmented areas. I think the one of the challenges is trying to figure out like where liberals can find some common ground to get some things done. And one of the consequences of the specialization that happened after the 1970s. Is that you have external interest groups that that have very high expectations and a kind of an ideal version of what they think should happen. Government doesn't produce ideal versions. And I think one of the challenges liberals are facing right now is how to find compromise mm-hmm. on good enough things, things that will be better than what we had before. Mm-hmm. And I think some of what the caller was mentioning, reflects some of that gap between the ideal of what we want to have happen and then kind of how do we create something positive and better through the institutions that exist. And I think the Build Back Better case is an interesting one. There are a lot of complexities to it. But I'm struck by the fact that there was a proposal last summer for, I think it was $1.7 trillion in spending, including, $500 or $600 billion in climate spending. And the Democrats, have been unable, and I think this comes from both sides, to come around a compromise of some kind. That would be better than nothing. And, the idea that somehow the liberals are going to leave on the table the possibility of spending $600 billion to mm-hmm. try to address climate issues is astonishing to me. But it is where we are in this gap between these different visions of what's possible and what should be done.
Yeah. So I also want to drill down just a little more on that point. I mean, so if we had Debbie Stabenow here talking with us in this conversation, she would point to some things that she would say are quite progressive that have they and quite large that they've gotten done in Washington. Of course, the Affordable Care Act, which was passed at the beginning of the Obama presidency, but also the infrastructure bill that was just passed at the beginning of the Biden presidency. And I think what she'd say is, we can't get everything we want. Those bills didn't perhaps go as far as everybody would have wanted them to go, but they are monumental reforms to the status quo, and they are the kind of thing that the kind of things that are possible in the current political in environment. So I think they would say that in some ways they're winning these arguments and these struggles, that they are still capable of getting things like that passed. How would you answer that?
Well, I mean, I think I would generally share a lot of that view. Just mm-hmm. I think that one of the issues that has happened is that prior to the 2020 election, there was a real sense of tremendous momentum on the liberal side and a hope that there was going to be a sweep in the Senate and there was going to be a dominant liberal coalition would be established in throwing, Trump and the GOP, out of office. And that didn't happen. We ended up with a 50-50 Senate. But I think that there's still sort of a desire for the 50-50 Senate to act as if it was a, 60-40 Senate or something like that. And it's just not possible. And I think that, so trying to figure out how do we, how do liberals build from where they're at to get to think about it more as a process and a long-term journey as opposed to immediately solving everything. So I think liberals need to think a little bit more about the longer-term process of building power and winning other Senate seats so that then a larger agenda can be accomplished. Mm-hmm. The loss of a few key seats really had a tremendous impact on what was possible.
Yeah. And at the same time, Paul, we're seeing this kind of rebirth of 60s-style activism, citizen activism with movements like Black Lives Matter and the urgency that they bring to the political discussion, but also to the thinking about policy. And here I'm thinking of, specifically about the police reform movement and decarceration. That's really important energy for liberals and the Democratic Party. They're less likely to settle for these incremental, I guess, wins, and you can argue about whether they're really incremental or not, but I think they would say that they're incremental and that what we really need is more substantive change. So there's this tension, I guess, that Democratic lawmakers in particular have to negotiate.
I think that's right. I mean, I think there is a tremendous amount of reform energy around very important issues like police reform, and I think that it has not necessarily always being channeled into strategies for accomplishing its vision, or necessarily rhetorical strategies that will work as effectively as hoped. A very, very complicated issue. But I certainly agree, with your description of that there's been a tremendous citizen energy around this, but it's been harder to translate into, institutional structures, because it's complicated. I think there's a sort of an abolition movement related to the police, that's running up against concerns about safety and trying to figure out how to create an institutional balance there, where the police, there's police reform that is addressing the issues that are being rightly singled out, but also not taking into consideration concerns that people have. Not my primary area, but I think that there are kind of analogies or similarities in patterns across these issues that are worth exploring.
Yeah, we've only got a couple minutes left, Paul, but I want to give you a chance to talk about things that you think could be done to restore faith in these big government programs and ideas. Things that the liberals and progressives could do. What can we do to make people believe again?
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to one of the things that I said earlier, which is part of the goal of my book is we need to have a more sort of mature attitude towards government, in which we recognize it as a flawed but necessary institution. And I think that would allow us to sort of express our frustrations, say, with the FDA or the CDC around some of the COVID-related things, but also seeing how those are essential institutions to support and to defend. And also reform. And so that's the balance that we're trying to strive for. I mean, I think if I were going to emphasize a couple of points looking back at this longer history, one is the importance of local and state government. And I think that the liberals coming out of the 60s and 70s grew overly enamored with federal solutions. They had a window of opportunity with a sympathetic federal judiciary and sympathetic, Democratic Congress for a time. And they came to see, going to Washington and solving things at the national level was how things were going to get done. And it really led a lot of talented people not to pursue careers in local and state government, and sort of trying to build up from the bottom. And if you look at the conservative strategy, whether it's the school boards or the state legislatures, that really has been the path that's been followed. I think the other. Yeah, so we could talk more about a lot of these different issues, but I think that trying to find I guess, a balanced approach to some of these, recognizing the problems that were rightly identified, but kind of not being so purist to not be able to kind of proceed to trying things and be, I guess I'm looking for a kind of pragmatism, really.
Yeah. Okay. Paul Sabin, professor of history at Yale and author of Public Citizens, The Attack on Big Government and the Remaking of American Liberalism. It was really, really great to have you here for this conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Okay, that's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when we're going to talk with Congressman Andy Levin about unions and his new labor bill allowing congressional staff to unionize and the right to collective bargaining. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station. Your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.